You're listening to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor, powered by bbbgive.org. Here we explore the motivations that form the basis of giving and service. We inspire generosity and celebrate the transformative effects that giving and service have on the human spirit and on community. The conversations featured on the podcast also uncover giving strategies that educate and provide tools to help listeners make impactful gifts of both their time and money. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Welcome to the Heart of Giving podcast, powered by bbbgive.org. Give.org is the nation's standards-based charity evaluator, and it's your one-stop source for information on giving and reports on the most asked about charities. I'm Art Taylor, your host, and with me today is Sarah Welsh from Ideas 42, who we're going to talk with about the work of her organization, but more specifically get into some of the trends that we're seeing in giving. And we're going to discuss many things about maybe concepts around why people are giving less to charities, or I shouldn't say that, we're actually giving more to charities, but less people are actually giving to charities. And some ideas Sarah may have around why that is occurring and what might we do about it, particularly given our data-driven society and our society that is really now less trusting of institutions. So Sarah, welcome to the Heart of Giving podcast.
Thanks, Art. I'm excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, first, Sarah, you know, we haven't really had much chance to get to know each other. And so I want to just spend a little bit of time just getting to know you a little bit. And I think our guests might find your background interesting as well. So how did you get to Ideas 42?
That is a great question. You have to go pretty far back. So Okay, so I started my career wanting to be a landscape architect. I started in New York City. I helped design public parks and wetland restorations and spent a lot of time. I was an ecologist for a while. I was super interested in trees and wetlands and public parks and dense urban spaces. And then I did that for a few years. And then I went to grad school. I'm pretty sure in grad school still that I wanted to stay in the environment space. But while I was in grad school, I took a class in behavioral economics, and I was sitting there and I had this epiphany that the thing that I was so excited about wasn't just trees and nature, right? But how people interacted with those spaces and how individuals' behavior and even sort of whole communities, how their interactions were driven by our environments and not just physical, but also emotional and social and cultural. And so when I was sitting there in this class and started to learn about behavioral science, behavioral economics, and realized like that is the framework that resonates for me. That is what I'm actually interested in. So I did grad school and then I discovered Ideas 42 and I haven't looked back since.
So what is the connection between that interest and Ideas 42?
Right. So Ideas 42 is a nonprofit organization that takes insights from the behavioral sciences, so behavioral economics, anthropology, sociology, those sort of decision-making sciences, and uses those insights to improve the design of programs and policies in the real world. So we try to have social impact in a variety of different focus areas. You know, that means, for example, how do we help people save more money? How do we help people take actions that make them healthier? How do we help college students stay in college and graduate. So looking at all the different places where you might see these sort of gaps between what humans want to do and what they are actually doing.
That's amazing because there's so many things that I want to do that do not align with what I actually do. To know that there's somebody out there helping with that, that's kind of fascinating. I mean, I'm a case study for you and not doing the things I should be doing.
Yeah, the personal angles are awesome too. I definitely feel like I've grown as gained some insight into my own behavior for sure.
Oh my goodness.
8 years of this.
So this is great. So tell me about some of the projects you've actually worked on.
Yeah, great question. So I myself have worked in many different areas. I did some work in climate space. So we've done some work on home energy assessments, right? So how do you get people to actually follow through on the energy efficiency upgrades that would help them save money and be better conservers of energy? So just all over the place, right? So I did that. And then I jumped over and did some really interesting work on WIC, Women, Infants, and Children,
yep,
program, right? Trying to help increase enrollment of eligible individuals in the program and then help them stay in the program longer, as long as they were still eligible for those benefits. And that was fascinating. I was also having my first child at the time. So it was like very personally meaningful to do that work. And then since a few years ago, I started working in our giving portfolio, and that has been very fascinating for me and really sort of triggered all of the interest that I had sort of come to behavioral science with to begin with, this whole question of like how communities interact and how you build spaces to encourage, yeah, resilient and strong communities. Yeah, so I've been doing that for the last few years, and that has taken up a lot of my time, but been really interesting.
Okay, so here's a general question for you, given the field that you're in. Are there general consistencies about how we behave as human beings? And you mentioned this whole business of there are things that we should do, we probably want to do, but we don't do. Are there particular issues that we have as human beings that separate us from the things that we want to do and should do?
Yeah, absolutely. So behavioral science is all about finding those predictable biases in how humans make decisions. So the overarching framework, the way to think about it, is as humans, we process a huge amount of information every day, right? So even just getting in your car and driving somewhere, you have to know how to operate this vehicle and go through your streets and then go to the store and get the thing you want and all that, right? So there's a lot of information coming at us. And if we were to sort of carefully sit there and process all that information as it came in, our brains would get overwhelmed immediately. And so instead, what happens is that our brain learns to take shortcuts. So our brain kind of looks at a situation, like a pattern, a context, and says, this is the car pattern. Like, this means that I put my hands on the steering wheel and I go. And so we don't have to process every single thing that's happening to us individually, right? And what behavioral scientists call that is system one thinking, sort of the automatic, easy way of processing information. And our brain is always trying to put things into that category because that takes less cognitive load on us, right? The other side is system two. That's when we're in a new situation, when we're doing something that requires a lot of thought. Our brain is actually trying to process all this information carefully and help us make decisions, again, in a very careful way. And that tension, though, between these two systems can lead to sort of less than optimal outcomes. So sometimes my brain is in system one, easy processing, right, when I actually want it to be thinking more carefully. So sort of classic example you might think of would be like procrastination. So our brain wants to take the sort of easy way. Procrastination comes from a bias we call present bias, where we tend to overemphasize things that are happening right now. So the benefits and costs in the present and at the expense of sort of future us, right? And so that's what procrastination really is that your brain just keeps saying, this is too much right now. Just kick it to the future. Worry about it in the future, right? But that is like a less than optimal outcome for many of us. We want to find ways to actually work on things now. So once you understand that pattern, then one way to tackle procrastination is to make your brain deal with things now. So create deadlines, create urgency, and then you can push yourself into that space you need to be in to complete the work. But there are lots of behavioral biases like this. A couple other examples, social norms. This is a really strong one, right? So when we're in a space where we are a little bit uncertain about what we're supposed to do, what the right behavior is, we often take cues, either consciously or unconsciously, from people around us. And those have to be people we perceive as our peers, right? So there's some nuance there. And when I say around us, right, that can be in the physical space, or it could just be kind of a perception you have in general about what you're supposed to do. But what we really see is social norms drive a ton of our behavior, our expectation of what we're supposed to do. And sometimes again, that leads to less than optimal outcomes, but there are ways to try to tweak that, to try to correct misperceptions of norms. I'm thinking of some research, for example, around college students and drinking. There's a classic problem where students often think that that fellow students drink more than they really do. If you survey them, they'll say people drink a lot more, but it's actually not true. And so there's been some successful interventions aimed at de-biasing students and kind of reminding them, actually, it's far fewer students than you think are really drinking a lot during the weekends, for example. And correcting those misperceptions can then lead to better outcomes.
Fascinating. I mean, there's so much you said that I could just, this is so me. So, you know, I'm a procrastinator. There's just no way to say it any differently.
We all tend to
put things off. And I feel that there are times when I could have gotten maybe better outcomes if I had, as you suggest, you know, maybe put some of these urgencies, if I had gamed my brain a little bit. That's what it sounds like you're saying. You should game your brain, create a deadline, you know, rather than saying I'm going to be there at 9 o'clock, just say you're going to, the thing starts at 8:30. You got to be there at 8:30. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, a lot of people do that. They set their clocks earlier so that when they look up, it's always early that they get to a place.
Right. You have to be careful with that though, because you become used to it. Right. And then you have to set it earlier.
Right. Right. Then you have to reset it. But we have to do these things you're saying to sort of trigger our brains to create this urgency if you're a procrastinator, or decide whether the decision that you're about to make is one that requires you to really engage with that decision or do something automatically. That's fascinating, because here again, when you focus on people who give, they're making that decision too. If we could just shift it to giving. And, you know, we tend to believe that people give primarily because they're asked. But when they're asked, they don't necessarily do a whole lot of homework to decide if that gift is the kind of gift they should be making, or if the charity, for instance, that they're giving to is one that they should be giving to. They'll basically decide based on the request and probably based on the amount of money they're asked to give, whether they're going to do it or not. And that is something that we're constantly fighting at the Wise Giving Alliance. You know, we want people to take more time between the ask and the decision to at least check out whether a charity is worthy of their support. But that is an uphill battle, because most people give based on emotion. If the appeal is right, if it moves them in some way, that is all their brains need in order to give. And in fact, it's been shown, I think, in some studies that the more information you give people, the less likely they are to give, because they're like, oh, this is too much. I can't process all this, so I won't make that decision. So it's kind of a disappointing thing for organizations like mine that is pushing the snowball uphill. We want people to take more time to make sure every gift matters by giving to organizations that are worthy of their support. But that's just not how we're wired. I mean, so what can we do about that kind of thing? How can you help an organization like ours, for instance, that's thinking, we want people to take more time and do something that seems unnatural?
Yeah, no, that is a big question. You've articulated it really well, this challenge. And I'll start by, again, kind of explaining the framework of the problem behaviorally, the way we would think about the challenge, right? Is that initial request where someone you know, or maybe someone you don't, right? They ask you for a certain amount of money to help this charity. And your instinct, again, because of how we're wired, we have this automatic reaction to kind of please people, right? So if my friend is running a race and wants me to donate to her cause, it's more about my relationship with that friend than about the charity or the cause that she's supporting. So in that moment, when that ask comes in, it's like a social automaticity kind of that happens, right? And so we give. What you actually want to do, right? So that's like a system one type of environment, type of scenario. What you really want to do is push people into system two, right? That's what you're talking about. So we want to get people out of that like immediate reaction and instead have them think through it, do a little research, think about if they actually want to support that that cause or that organization. And that's really hard because, again, that's not how humans are wired, right? We want to stay in that system one. So I think if you frame the problem like that, then there are a couple of interesting solutions. One, broadly, you kind of have two options. Either you figure out a way to push people into system two, or you figure out a way to inject some evidence or information into that system one space. And that can be really hard, but we've looked at both sides. So we have sort of two different models, right? On the one side, here's the challenge. Once you get people into system two, you don't want to lose them. As you said, right? If you give them too much evidence, then maybe they actually kind of get paralyzed and now they've come away from that space and now they're not going to give at all. So can you, in that system two space, can you get donors in a moment where they are starting to feel that interest in giving and then provide them information in that moment? Or can you send them something that will sort of trigger them to want to give? So I'll just give you a specific example, something that we came up with that was promising. Again, didn't solve the problem completely, right? Because it's hard, but promising. We created something we called a personal giving review, and we did this with DAF donors. So folks who, you know, have a fair amount of money they've already put aside for giving. And we sent them this year in review summary of how they had given that year and didn't give them any specific advice on, you know, give in a certain way. But it was one of our hypotheses is that donors really don't have a moment to reflect and look back and say, oh, I gave to these organizations and some of these organizations aligned with what I care about, but some of them didn't. And that absent that moment of reflection, it's really hard for donors to then think in a future way about how they might want to correct that. And so this email, it was actually worked in a couple levels. So one, it triggered that moment of reflection, right? And maybe prompted some donors to think about their giving that way. But it also just straight up captures your attention, right? It makes you think about giving and hopefully triggers that sort of discovery process. So it did increase giving. It caused the initial versions of it had some interesting effects where part of our goal was to get DAF holders to grant out more from their accounts. But what we sort of saw was like a balancing effect. So people who had granted out a lot were more likely to kind of increase their contributions rather than further increase their grants out and then vice versa. So we think something like that is promising. Again, it provides that moment of reflection. It gives you some feedback. It helps you start to think about how you've given in the past and maybe triggers you to think more consistently about your future giving. The other set of strategies is how do you, forgive my language here, but like, how do you hijack that moment of giving where you're feeling impulsive and you want to make this gift and make it easy for donors to just give to a good organization? And when you start thinking that way, you end up in a set of solutions, maybe that's around, say, like curation. So how do you begin with, like, give donors a list of organizations that they can trust and that they can kind of rely on without having to do all of their own research? Because again, it's really hard to get donors to do research. And we've done some work on that as well. So we created a few of these lists that were, they had a branding called Give List, and it worked pretty well. Again, it's a good way to capture attention. Here's a list of 8 organizations. You can't do too many because you'll overload people again, but doing some work in a space and giving people that shorter list definitely prompted increased giving. I think there's a lot more to be done there. There's a lot of questions that raises, right? About like equity and who's curating and how often do you switch up those lists and how do you vet those organizations? So I think that's a space for more work.
Fascinating. No, that's fascinating because you give me an idea actually to think about. Maybe we can give donors a report card on how they've given. But tell us who you gave to and we'll tell you, you know, whether they met standards and which ones they didn't meet and so forth, and try to give them more of an interactive assessment of what their giving habits have been. And if that does what you say, maybe later on causes them to think for a minute before they simply respond, then that's a good thing. You know, that could be a really helpful way to get people to transition and help us push that snowball up the hill. We hear a lot from people though, particularly older people who get our magazine in the mail, that they won't make a gift until they check out a charity in the magazine. That's great, but if to get younger people more focused on that is a real challenge, because again, the instinct is my friends are giving, so they're taking social cues, right? My friends are giving to this thing, I'm going to do it. Or our school has picked this group and no one's actually checked out the group. It's just everybody's given to that, so that's what we're doing. And now you see on social media many opportunities for people to give for someone's birthday or something like that. We don't vet the charity. We just say, oh, my friend's having a birthday fundraiser, so I'm going to support them more than they really care about the charity. They're supporting the individual. And we're influenced by lots of different things, as you know, studying behavioral science as you do. Sometimes we're influenced by what third parties say or what authority figures say. Well, we're trusting authorities a lot less, so we're not relying on them as much. So maybe we're relying more on things like testimonials or insight from people who we know personally. And we just sort of say, if they think it's okay, then I'm going to be okay with it. Well, maybe that person hadn't done any work, so they're just going off instinct as well. So, but anyway, you've given me a lot to think about here as we consider ways to help our donors do better by the charities that need their support and get some donors back in the game. So let's switch to that for a little bit. So why do you think we see this decline in the number of people donating? I've said on the podcast a number of times that between the years 2000 and 2016, the number of people giving to charity declined from about 66%, I think it is, down to 49.5%. So the amount of money that charities are receiving has actually gone up over that time period. And we're talking about a time period around 2016, 2017, when those numbers were calculated. The number of people has gone down, even though the amount of money has gone up. So people who are wealthier are actually giving more, which is great. But that says something about our society too. If everyday people who aren't, you know, super millionaires or super billionaires are giving money. And I'm just curious what you think from a behavioral standpoint, what might be happening?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a critical question. And I'd add that also the challenge is that as much as, you know, we certainly want people who can afford it to, like people who have a lot of wealth to donate that wealth for sure.
Absolutely.
There is an argument of sort of democratizing giving too, right? Like making sure that we have a voice so that it's not just the billionaires making the decisions about what's important. And so it is important to have greater participation. I think, you know, and I do think it's a really complicated challenge. So I don't purport to know all of the answers, but I will offer one perspective that I've been thinking a lot about based on that sort of, again, that behavioral framing. So I can share this. Actually, I think about this story. One of our early projects was with the Combined Federal Campaign, the CFC. And they had seen decline, just like you're talking about, right? Declining giving rates for the last decade or so, more than that, right? Two decades. And we're trying to fix that problem. And when people were trying to initially fix this, right? I think one big hypothesis was like, well, you know, part of the reason giving has gone down is that it's always hard to give. It's hard to give, you know, you have to write a check or you have to, I don't know, maybe it's just hard. And nowadays, this thing, everything starts to go online. Like, well, maybe we could make it easier via a digital tool. Like, let's give people a digital platform where they can just really quickly make a donation. And I don't think that's wrong. Like, yes, making it easy is always, generally from a behavioral perspective, is good. Like, we want to make things easy. But I think there's this risk. So the CFC, the way it used to work is that, forgive me, I may not use exactly the right language, but there were team captains who would have clipboards, right? And walk around the office and they'd say, hey, Art, are you going to give to this charity that I care about? You know, how much can you give? And you would feel a little bit of social pressure in that situation to give. And again, I don't, like, it's tricky because on the one hand, I don't want you to feel pressured to give. But on the other hand, if it makes you feel good afterwards, like maybe it's not that bad of a, you know, it's kind of part of being in a community. So that's kind of the old way of doing it, right? But it was all on paper instead. When the CFC switched to an online platform, that was the year that they actually saw the biggest drop in giving. So suddenly what had happened is you removed the team captain walking around with the clipboard, and instead you asked people to do it online. And now I can't tell, Art, if you are giving or if you're like playing solitaire or something on your computer, right? You've removed those, the sort of social visibility sight lines. And so for better or worse, I feel like sometimes when we design these digital tools, they actually, while they make it easier to give, they can also make it easier to not give, because you aren't sort of in that space where you're being, the word pressure sounds too negative, but where you're feeling that influence, right? Like you're part of a community, or you've got these people who are important to you who also care about this cause.
I totally think that's part of what's going on. I mean, if you look at the combined federal campaign and also United Way, which was another really, and still is, by the way, a very powerful engine to drive large numbers of donations through workplace giving. If you look at those two activities alone, those two engines, they're operating differently than they used to. United Way, you would go to an office, if you worked in an office or anywhere, someone would come around and say, yeah, you know, we're competing with the department down the street or the next building across, and we want to make sure that our donations outpace theirs. How much can you give? Even if it's $5, every amount matters. And you do it. You know, it's $5. I'm putting it. It's going to come out my payroll. I won't even notice it. And I feel like I've done something good. Yes, there was some pressure. There was some pressure. And I think as a society, we're now rejecting that kind of pressure in the workplace. And, you know, I get it. You know, people are not wanting to feel pressured to do things. But, you know, how much is that really pressure? I mean, all you got to do is say no. And I understand for some people, that's hard to do, right? It's hard to say no, especially when someone asks. That's why, you know, fundraising is so effective when you can get in front of a person and ask for money, because it's hard to say no to a good cause. It's hard to say no, right? So if it's only a few dollars, we'll probably say yes if we can do it. So not having those engines, I believe, is one of the key reasons why we're seeing a decline in the number of people donating. I'm not saying that's the full thing, the full reason for it, but it's got to be one of the reasons, because we say the reason people give, the number one reason people give, is because somebody asked them. And asking somebody in person, there's nothing more powerful than that. So I agree with you. I think now that's a behavioral, we've lost a behavioral advantage, right? By not having the clipboard go around.
Right.
So how do we replace the clipboard? I mean, what do we do? If we can't like ask people directly in the workplace, peer to peer, to give, what do we do? How do we gin this back up somehow?
Right. So I think you got to think about creatively about, in the digital space, how do you still have those sort of social sight lines, which is a new term I've just made up on the spot. So you see this a little bit with some social media, right, where you can start, you can kind of, if you give to a cause, everyone can see you giving to that. So, you know, there's some angles there, I think, where you look to insert that social piece, or to go back to that personal giving review kind of idea, right? You can use something like that to also give people some benchmarks. So even if they can't see the giving happening in the moment, remember how we talked about it's important, just the perception of social norms, right? So even if you can't see the giving happening, but the perception is that people are giving, then that can help. So if you are, in addition to saying like, this is how you gave over the last year, you can also tell people how they compared to other givers like them, right? And sort of use those more subtle nudges to get folks to, again, see that, leverage those social norms.
So that's another great idea. So now you give me two things. One is to give people a report card on how they're giving, whether those things they've given to actually are making a difference in some way. And then secondly, saying to people, you know, you give, you know, $1,000 a year, let's say, and people in your situation, however we define that, are giving $1,100 a year, or they're giving $900 a year, whatever it is. And now you can say, oh, okay, well, I'm kind of in a ballpark. I could probably do a little bit better, or maybe I'm doing a little bit better. Yay for me. Maybe that kind of drives some additional thought about it and makes them feel good, and gives, by giving them that context, right? Some additional context around what their gift actually means and how they're doing in relation to other people. Fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely. And then I would couple it, also throw in, make it easy to take an action. Give them a curated list right then. So then they don't have to do that additional research, but then, you know.
So like the Netflix thing where you're watching a movie and when that movie's over, they give you five more just like it so that you keep binge watching.
Right, exactly. Encourage some binge giving.
Right. Fascinating. Well, you know, we're getting to sort of to the end of this, and I want to give you a chance to just talk about what you see the future of behavioral sciences and how it can really help us think through the causes that matter to us and expand what we do to improve our society in different ways. What are you seeing? What do you see, I guess I should say?
Yeah. I mean, I think the advantage of the behavioral viewpoint is that you recognize that just giving people information alone isn't enough, you know? So there are two sides to that. So one, it can be kind of frustrating to feel like, hey, I'm telling someone how to do something right, or I'm giving them information, you know, if we're talking about giving, I'm giving people advice on how to give well, and they're not doing it. But the flip side of that is to recognize that what you see, the behaviors we observe, don't really say anything about people's intentions, because there's a lot more going on, right? So just because you don't see somebody taking action on that email you sent, or just because you don't see someone, to go back to some earlier examples, going to the gym or saving money, right, doesn't mean that they don't want to do those things. Instead, there might be other things getting in the way. And that's where the behavioral framework can be really helpful, to think about, okay, well, what could be getting in the way? Like, what are they dealing with? What's going on around them? With giving, one big thing is that people have a lot of other things happening, and giving is kind of, unfortunately for most folks, like an extra, right, on top of all the other daily activities they have. So if you start to recognize, like, look, this is the context we're operating in, then you can start to see solutions that can either work within that context or change it. So in general, I think that I get really excited about the behavioral approach, again, both in my own life, right, and then more broadly, especially when you start to think about some really challenging problems. I think about climate a lot as an example of something that is actually highly behavioral. Unfortunately, climate change is this far in the future, vague, difficult to understand threat. And that's like the worst for humans in terms of our biases, right? It triggers all the worst biases. But if we can start to understand the behavioral reality, then we can try to design different solutions. So that behavioral reality tells you to just like, stop trying to get people to understand at that level. Like, they're just not going to understand at that level. So instead, what are the smaller steps you might want people to take? Or are there upstream decisions you can change so that people make, it makes it easier for people to take the right step? So anyway, I think when you start thinking about those trickier sort of pro-social actions, right, they're all kind of similar. Giving is another thing that benefits not you as an individual, but your community as a whole. Civic engagement, voting, right? Those things are all good for communities, but on the individual level, it's not always clear what the immediate benefit is. But that's where I think behavioral science can provide some really interesting solutions.
Well, Sarah, I really appreciate you joining me for this episode of the Heart of Giving podcast. And to all of our guests who maybe you're checking in now for the first time, I hope you subscribe to our show. You can find us on all major podcast platforms. And if you're so inclined to make a gift, as we've been discussing today, you can go to our website, give.org, and make a donation to the Wise Giving Alliance. And you can also follow us, please, on social media. And also make sure that you share this information with others in your network. Thank you for listening, and we look forward to having you tune into a future episode.
You've just listened to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor. Be sure to tune in next time for a brand new episode. To listen to our other interviews, visit heartgiving.podbean.com. That's heartgiving.podbean.com. Subscribe to our show on major podcast platforms. The thoughts and opinions expressed on this podcast are the views and opinions of the guests, not those of the BBB Wise Giving Alliance or program affiliates. This podcast is for information and educational purposes only and is copyrighted with all rights reserved. This podcast is protected by Podbean's terms of service.